Welcome to my podcast, Chief Energy Officer, Time to Lead. My name is Boris Diekmann, and today I'm joined by Dr. Patty Canciola. Most people refer to her simply as Dr. Patty. Patty has been a veterinarian for, over 30 years. You'll correct me if I'm wrong. She won the American Humane Hero Veterinarian Award. She became more widely known through and to the public through the National Geographic TV series Rocky Mountains Animal Rescue. She's been the CEO of the St. Martin's Well Pet Care and the Amazing Amos Pet Food Pantry, and she's now a very, very fulfilled practicing veterinarian and also very much caring about, younger people becoming a veterinarian in their lives. She'll share more about that in a moment. For now, Patty, welcome from the bottom of my heart. Thank you for making the time for human conscious leadership.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure to spend this time with you. Since you have come into my life, you are always, when we communicate, just a bright spot in my day. You are extremely special. And I thank you for inviting me. I was quite honored.
Thank you. That's absolutely on both sides. I think in a moment we'll come back to how our journey actually started. But before we go there, Patty, just share a little bit more about yourself, about your role, what you're doing, and maybe what are you truly doing when you're doing what you're doing? So what gives you life?
Gosh, that's a really good question, because I sometimes try not to define who I am by what I do. But I truly believe that if we love what we do and we're good at what we do, then perhaps that is who we are. And veterinary medicine has always been in the forefront of my life. From growing up as a young age, this is what I wanted to do. And I was bound and determined, and it happened. The dream came true. But part of that, on the flip coin of that thinking mind and that studying mind, there's always this creative level in me. And so just recently, I've picked up watercolor, which led into oil painting and tapped back into my calligraphy. So I have a friend who kind of coined where I am now in my life is I'm this budding artist and I love what I do, but I'm also a veterinarian. So she has coined me the artinarian, because I see that I put passion into both arenas, because at some point when my career is over, it will be nice to have this artistic experience to fall back on. And then am I the artist, formerly the veterinarian? Am I still the veterinarian, now the artist? So I think, yes, what defines me is the obsession that I have with something and I don't let it go. And then everything is about that. So for 30-some years, I've been a very hardworking veterinarian, a very compassionate veterinarian. As we spoke briefly, it's not just the pets that I'm taking care of now in general practice. It's their owners. And in shelter medicine, we don't see the owners because we are dealing with orphaned and abandoned animals. Now in general practice, it's a flip of the coin. There are people that you make connections with, that you become friends with, that you become close to. Just yesterday, I had an older client come in, and at the end of that 45 minutes, it was all about her. And so we spent the 45 minutes, five of which was spent talking about the dog who's in great shape, but I've sensed that she comes to see me, to visit, to have that connection, and she feels good by the time she's left. And then I run into her 20 minutes later at the grocery store, and the conversation carries on. So I see my connection, not only with the pet, but the people, because I think we end up treating both.
I'm just thinking, it's probably the first ordinarian I've ever met. and I so love the thought that you're offering, that it's not the profession that defines who you are. It's who you are that defines the profession and what it becomes. You know, there's only one person who embodies this the way you do. And I was just thinking, maybe it's the moment to just share, because that's where everything started when we first experienced you in a two-dimensional thing called a television, and how we met. I think it's important to share that. So the person responsible for us sitting here is my daughter, I think. Sophia.
Yes.
Because during the pandemic, so when we're all doing homeschooling and watched a little bit more television than on average, she saw you, on Rocky Mountains Animal Rescue, and we watched it. And so after, watching two of them, she said, yeah, I want to become a vet. I want to become a vet. Oh. And we went, yeah, sure, darling, no problem. You can become anything you want. Fine. And then watched it again. And then she said, I love Dr. Patty. I want to write to her. And we said, yeah, sure. Go ahead. And my wife said, well, let's just write a postcard. So we wrote a postcard and sent it to the letterbox. And we were secretly going, a postcard to the United States from Europe during the pandemic. Will it ever arrive? And if it arrives, will she respond? And if yes, how will she respond? And so Sophia was asking pretty much every day, has it arrived? I said, darling, it's a couple of thousand kilometers. Just be patient. And then there was this one day when we looked in our letterbox and there wasn't a letter. There was a whole gray package. And we opened it together. And in there were a lot of little gifts that represented animals and pens and stickers and other things. There was a beautiful handwritten card from you appreciating her English and her reaching out. And a book, Dr. Doolittle, in which you wrote, that's what I read when I was your age and inspired me becoming a vet. And I remember, and that's actually why I wanted to share this, I remembered how this very warm feeling of generosity flowed through my body and through Sophia and through my wife. And as I'm recalling this, the tears come back. We were so deeply moved by this feeling of generosity.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, you brought them back to me too.
Yeah. And that's the first thing I recall. The first experience that you offered to me was to re-experience the power of generosity as an infinite source of abundant energy and creating bridges between people who've never met. You and I never had the pleasure to meet. We'll change that at some stage. And Sophia learned that she could be in touch with anyone. So on the one, I wanted to share that for everyone and with you. This is 2 years ago, or 3 years ago, when then I asked you a couple of months ago, hey, Patty, you want to come to the podcast? I think it took 5 seconds. I said, yeah, sure, no problem. I would be honored. So, so you didn't hesitate a second. I wanted to ask you, what inspired you to be here today?
You. My connection with you, my connection with Sophia, your family, your book it changes a lot of thoughts and emotions and feelings. And just as you say, we've never met in person, but there's this invisible energy connection that I feel extremely happy, comfortable, and connected to you on so many different levels. And so anytime there's an opportunity or a message from LinkedIn from Boris, it's just like, I gotta read it right now. What is it? So yeah, you're a very important part of my life, as Sophia is as well. So it's like there's a friendship, there's a connection that is extremely special and very important. So yeah, I was all about doing this with you.
Oh, thank you. It means it is absolute reciprocal, and maybe there's a connection to right now, because this podcast, we don't know who's going to listen to it. We're just sending out a gift in one way or another. So if people could experience this podcast as a gift, what would you like it to be? So what would you like this little podcast to carry? What would you like it to be about?
Oh my gosh, that's such a deep question. You mentioned something in your initial guided meditation. What gift would we offer? And I think there are so many gifts that we each have that we have yet to even tap into. But I think for me, it's the gift of, like you said, generosity. And it doesn't have to be things. It can be thoughts, it can be conversation, it can be words, it can be time, it can be listening. So I think for me, who's ever listening, in whatever you do, whatever profession, whatever your craft, chances are there's more than one person out there admiring what we do, wanting to be who we are, what we are, where we are. And don't be afraid to let them approach you. And be free to be there for them as an example, as a mentor, as a source to answer their questions. It's like Sophia. That's why I recently sent her a stethoscope, because it's my way of saying, you can do this, you will do this, and I will watch you do this. And so I think it's once you find the one person who has tapped in to what I do and they look up to me, my gift is to always be there to help her, to encourage her, to push her, to motivate her. Because it's not going to be easy, and it takes a special individual to do what we do because of the emotions involved. Once you find that one little person, that's the seed for the next generation. And I think our gift is to be there for them.
I'm so glad you're sharing that, because in so many ways, I think we are now at the very heart of leadership. A very, very dear friend and mentor who in many ways became the inspiration for the Chief Energy Officer book. And years ago, I asked him, So what is leadership? And he didn't hesitate a second and said, well, it's love. What else would it be? And that got me thinking for many, many years. And I think generosity, the way you express this, is one way of expressing love. And I probably need to share with our listeners what you just referred to in terms of the stethoscope, because a few months ago, a second package arrived, and we unpacked it together with Sophia, and then she found the stethoscope, and then she read the card, and I think that's when she realized, oh, that's Dr. Patty's stethoscope, and she's giving that to me. Tears poured down her eyes because she was grasping the meaning of encouragement, of belief in her, of seeing a future that you already see. And so you've become a leader in her life. And you were just talking about the human being, not the animal, that you were a leader for in this moment. So I wanted to ask you, you know, so you've learned to become a vet and learn how to be there for animals. When in your life did you realize for the first time that besides being a vet, you would need to become a full-time leader too?
Because it's like you talked about earlier, where you have people in lead positions and then you're going to have people in the background. And some of these people you don't see, but they make everything happen. What I do, who I am responsible for, and my daily, my daily responsibility, I don't do it by myself. I usually have a team behind me. There's people answering the phones, cleaning the kennels. My left hand, my right hand, they're in with the exam room with me. And even though they too love the profession, they have also worked in other areas where they didn't have that cohesive relationship with who they work with. And so I feel as though when the people that I work with go from feeling like my employees or my assistants or my coworkers to where we feel like a family, because there's not very many of us in a very small building, and we either are going to get along or we're going to struggle. And this is probably the best team I've ever had in a long time. And sometimes I'm not the leader. Sometimes I'm having an off day. Sometimes it's another doctor taking over leadership. Sometimes my technicians will say, "Oh, this is a tough day for you. Here, what can I do for you? How can I help you get through this day?" So I think at some point, we all become leaders to each other. And I don't know what the word for that would be, but I never thought that. And the other day I finally stopped somebody and I said, "Why, if you have three doctors in the building, why are you always coming to me?" And they said, "Because you're the leader." And I thought, wow, I didn't think that at this point in my career, I would be responsible for a hospital with doctors underneath me, but here I am. And I think I just fell into that role without a lot of real hard leadership training. But I think the people that I surround myself have helped me become the best leader I can be.
Oh, Patty, I'm so glad you're sharing that, because that which you said, I think is, you share that with so many people who were starting their journey, becoming good at their craft, at their profession, and then, you know, not even aware it became leaders over time or not, and feeling not equipped for it yet, and still needing to kind of carry that weight for their people. So that's actually one reason why I was so looking forward to having you, because you didn't start a journey, what I want to be is a leader for the people. He said, I want to become a veterinarian and maybe also an artist, you know. And so I think that you share with many people. And secondly, initially, one wouldn't probably think about that a leadership role is needed. But then I was thinking about your daily environment when I watched, you know, one of the series again. And I thought, you work in an environment that is fast-paced, to a large extent unpredictable. You don't know in the morning what's going to happen. It's definitely high stress. There is ambiguity, because you will not always know what's the right thing to do. Very high expectations, both from the animal and their owners. There is probably a high level of emotions, including fear and worry and tension. And at the same, in this environment, you probably need to deliver precision, thoughtfulness, patience. So it's almost impossible. So in that environment, what can you share? What have you learned about what's the role of a leader in that environment? And maybe you can add to what that environment actually is. I'm just imagining it, right?
Well, you hit on a word that, if anybody knows me, that's the one thing that I'm very sometimes short supply on, it is patience, because of high expectations, because I always want to make sure that I'm doing the absolute best, that I don't make a mistake. And when I do make a mistake, I really carry that. And so even yesterday, I was working on a very complicated dental, and my nurse says, "Wow, I don't think I remember a time when you've had this much patience during a procedure, especially this kind of procedure," because it was a cat dental, and cat teeth are so fragile. It's like handling porcelain, and you don't want to leave behind a root. And I was bound and determined to get this 1 millimeter root from this socket. And I just had to tap into my breathing, which we did. And I was able to then focus. And I just kept telling myself, patience, patience, patience. And I finished it. It went beautifully. The cat went home, doing very well this morning. And it's all because the one thing that I always lack is the one thing that I really try to focus on, and that's patience. Patience not only with myself, but my physical talent, but just letting go of always having to be perfect all the time. That perfectionist that's in the back of my brain that says, just breathe, trust yourself, and it's going to be okay.
The sense I'm getting is you picked on the notion of patience. Is what you did for yourself there is you created the space that could hold the nervousness and maybe the restlessness, and that helped you, you know, through breathing. You created that space in your body. And I was wondering, I think you're one of those who just do this naturally. What do you do for others to create a space where they can be at their best? And I'll just share with you what I noticed just watching you on television. So I noticed you bring, in this environment that we just described, you bring playfulness, humor, and encouragement, a lot of lightheartedness when there are many other things to feel. That's what I just from watching what I noticed. So sometimes you might do that unintentionally and sometimes very intentionally. So what does being a leader in that environment mean for you? What do you do that, what have you discovered that tends to help people to be at their best in spite of the odds? And maybe limit the damage when we're not at our best from time to time.
I always just make a point to just check in with them, just them personally. How are you doing? How are you feeling? How can I help you? Something as simple as making a phone call on the way into work and say, "Hey, you're my surgical team. Would you like a coffee on my way in?" You know, trying to treat them in such a way that they know that I love them, that I care about them, that I enjoy working with them, that I'm putting my arms around them, giving them bear hugs, like, come on, we can do this. Just that team environment, so that they know that, yes, I may be the doctor, but I can't do this without each and every one of you. And a lot of times we can usually tell when somebody is off. And they'll come up to me and say, hey, they'll shoulder bump me and they'll say, hey, Dr. Patty, I got you today. And then I'll say, okay, well, I've got you next time. So it's that constant, I think, being aware of maybe their facial expression is different for the day. They're not smiling as much. Their eyes look different. Their body language. And I think I'm pretty good at picking up on that. I have a lot of empathy. I tend to be a sponge, and I can usually pick up on something and say, what's going on? You know, what can I do to help you? And you're right. I sometimes don't know what to do with heavy emotion. So yeah, my thing is to throw a little humor and let's have a little fun and lighten up the situation, because I don't know how to deal with the really heavy grief. It's an uncomfortable type of situation for me to see somebody really struggling. But if I can just put my hand on theirs, put my hand on their back, especially the grieving clients, their bodies change. They just relax, like, okay, somebody can hear me, somebody can see me, somebody understands where I'm coming from. And so I just try to either approach with some type of comfort, whether it's a physical touch, a hug, a comment, or a gift, maybe, that would make them smile. It's usually where I try to come from.
I'm so glad that you're bringing grief in. It's mm-hmm. one of the strong feelings, because I believe yeah. it's not only happening where you'd expect it to happen. So where doctors operate,
yeah.
grief will be present. You know, in the last podcast with Martin Schlott, we, you know, he talked about that and how to digest grief and failure. And so I think this happens in other organizations too, where, you know, grief happens as soon as we need to separate from something that isn't there anymore. It's mm-hmm. colleagues who leave. It's not only death. It's just any separation from a situation, from something we're used to, that creates smaller and larger grieving processes, and then the very large ones that you talked about. So what role does grief play? If grief is part of our natural intelligent emotions, one of the strong ones, and what role does grief play?
Grief, for me, I encounter grief every single day. I think with the number of pets that we see and the owners, a lot of owners deal with grief. And once you've made that personal connection with the owner, and they've gone from becoming just the client number 26, whatever, then you start to remember their first name and their last name. And when you see them on the schedule, now you have their faces because you're making these connections. And there is euthanasia every day. And at this point in this particular practice, I have met all these clients at least once or twice. And so now I've gone from the new doctor they didn't know to now the new doctor who sits next to them, who sits eye level with them, in a chair with them. And I talk to them like they're friends or their family. And when it comes time for that pet to die, that takes it, I think, to a deeper level, because I continue to hear from these people. They don't have pets, but they always continue to reach out. They have my phone number. I get texts. Hi, how you doing? And that's no longer Dr. Patty. Now to them, I'm Patty. And so I have made connections through grief, because I check in on them. They check in on me. They know this profession is very emotional. one of the reasons that veterinarians have the highest suicide rate is because of grief and emotion that we carry all day, every day. It's a tough subject to talk about.
And I'm glad that you're willing to.
Yeah.
And I think we can all feel what you're in touch with right now. And I'm so glad that on one hand you're sharing it's grief is also a pathway to stay in connection. But it also means that you are creating the space for others to hold that grief for them. Would you agree that leaders are healers?
Oh, most definitely. Because I don't know maybe the right words, but it's that grief that once it's inside and you can't carry it, and I come home and I do my walks and I do my bike and I let all that go and I offer it up as I took the grief, took the experience, helped them through it. I'm glad I was the one to be there because I have this, I think it's an innate ability with this profession to let it go. Leave it for the day because I am going to expect it to be there tomorrow to do it all over again. And I don't know what the internal process is to let that go, but I can and I do because I'm going to have to feel that spot in again to help somebody. So I think, again, yeah, we can cure disease, we can fix a broken bone, we can do a surgery, we can get the animal back on track, but the emotional part of that journey is there for a long time. And it's trying to combine the two and yet find the strength to go in the next day to do it again. So that's why I think it takes a really special person to do veterinary medicine because it's not black and white. It's not fix and out the door.
Yeah. Just feel like taking a moment and taking a breath to just acknowledge and honor the feeling that is there right now. I think it's just not the two of us right now. It's all your patients that are in this conversation right now, right? And all those animals and all those who work with you. And I often hear, and there is a truth in that, like, how can I let go? And I'm also wondering, well, how can I be with the grief and lean in? And we're doing a little bit of that right now.
Yeah, you just have to sit with it and sit with it and sit with it again.
So in that spirit, because you said, you know, so many of the suicide rates in a profession like yours is high. And I don't know about other professions, but I know that all professions are highly emotional. I think we fool ourselves. I often hear like, oh, forgive me for being so emotional. Thinking, how would you not be? You know, the only way to not be emotional is to be dead. Well, how can you be with that more often? So I was curious, how do you create space for yourself? What are practices that you have to heal yourself, to have that spaciousness so that the next day you can hold someone else? What is working for you?
Oh, I think there's a lot of little things. There's not one particular big thing. But before we started to record, you took us through this wonderful, beautiful guided meditation. And so I've been trying to get back into that myself. And there's, if you're familiar with Sharon Salzberg, in one of her podcasts, she talks about being there just counting your breaths and see how many breaths you can go before there's a distraction. Well, for me, it's always like one or two, and then there's that distraction. So, but I find that when I have a guided meditation, very much like you offered in the beginning, that really helps to, yes, the thoughts are there, and yes, the thoughts throughout the day, and I can see the thought, acknowledge the thought, and let it go. But for me, a lot of times it's the walk in silence. It's the listening to the noises around me. It's letting it just go and acknowledging the fact that thank you for allowing me to do what I do as best as I can. And just finish a walk or finish an art piece or spend time with one of my dogs or visit with family. I don't know that there's any one thing, because each of those has a special place at the end of my day. And it may be one, or it may be all, or it may be a few things. But I find, for me, silence, to, as you said perfectly, to just lean in and acknowledge those feelings, and all of those feelings are okay.
It's so wonderful what you're sharing. I'd just like to kind of double click on that, if that's the right word, silence. There is a huge space for silence. To be able to lead requires silence. That's what I just heard. And
and
being with what is, so that it can be digested. There's work of you. I think what you're describing is the process of digesting. Because digestion is not only food to be digested, it's emotions, it's experiences, it's conversations that need to be digested. And we have so many of those.
There's that noise that we talk to. And what is that noise? For me, the noise could be thoughts, worry, what ifs that go through my mind. I sometimes wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning, And I joke that the mind traffic starts, and it's that kind of noise. It doesn't have to be a physical noise that comes into my ear. It's sometimes the noise in our minds. And I think the meditation aspect that I really try to do as best I can is to get rid of that noise, acknowledge that thought, and let it go. Because here's another thought, and let it go. But it's that internal noise that I like to let go.
I think there are many people who can relate to that.
Oh, I'm sure there are. Yeah.
And as I find it comforting when we hear, "Hey, I'm not alone with that. We're all on that journey." And as you were talking, you know, we start our conversation around the power of generosity, which you just embody, and the gratitude that comes with that. And on the other hand, there's grief. And I was reminded of a quote from Francis Weller, and he said, "Our ability to receive love is proportionate to the capacity to welcome all of who we are. The work of the mature person is to carry grief in the one hand and gratitude in the other and be stretched large by them. How much sorrow can you hold? That's how much gratitude you can give." And I feel you're a wonderful example that he's seen something, Francis.
Well, Francis, I think I may have to get that quote from you, because that's pretty powerful.
You know, I was wondering, with all those things that you've shared that intuitively guide you, some of the frontiers you meet when you found this is difficult, and you meet your own frontiers, and some of the things that you pay attention to, the way you think about your team and how you can support them in some very simple and sometimes very difficult ways.
if you think about, you said it before, you didn't start out as a leader. You know, you started studying one day when you were younger. And I was wondering, if you think about how you're leading today, and you've learned from others too, and pivotal moments or people or stories that informed or shaped the way you look at your leader today and at people? So what were moments or people that kind of inspired you where you felt like, and that maybe helped to make you see the world how you see them today and become the leader who you are today?
Well, I think because I've been out so many years, I've had the opportunity to have a small handful of mentors. I've always been at various hospitals for long enough to be mentored and guided and learn by their example how I wanted to be if I was ever in that position. And one of the very first ones was a veterinarian. He was like James Herriot. And he was tall, and he carried himself just elegant, and he smiled and he laughed. And he had this big head of white hair, and he just looked the part. And I thought, I wonder if that will be me someday. And I used to watch him practice, and it was like watching him paint or do something. He would pull all these different bottles off the shelf and drop everything in the same syringe. And it always turned out to be a nice color of yellow or pink. And I thought, how does he do that? It's like magic. Well, I feel like I have become Dr. Kraus, in essence, because I'm doing the same thing. I can think, and I grab this and I grab this and I just do it. And I thought, I'm doing exactly what he did. Or I've worked with doctors who taught me the art of communicating and listening and what to do with your hands, what not to do with your hands, when it's okay to hold a client's hand when they're crying. And I was able to learn from Dr. Tom how to do that. So I've always been perhaps lucky enough in my position over the years to team up with who I feel were the true definition of loving what they do, caring for the client to do the best for the pet. And it just showed in their mannerisms. And then I've had really, really good examples outside of this profession, watching people in a leadership position in the community and how she got to where she was and the struggles. And the struggles were not easy, yet she comes across as, but it's important enough to go through this struggle to do what I do. And you have to just put that rhino skin on and just keep fighting for what you believe. And I think on that aspect, it's helped me to face some pretty difficult challenges in my career. One of those challenges was when I had no choice but to close one of my hospitals and watch all my clients have to go someplace else. I had to do a career shift. And that was probably the most traumatic moment of my professional career. But because I had everything that I had learned and this best friend who was just, come on, you can do this, you're a warrior, got me through that. So it's been the strong leaders in my profession and outside of my profession who have set an example for me to be where I am today. So in the beginning, let's be grateful for all the people in our lives that got us here. Those are those people.
And one of them was there for you when it was difficult and you didn't know how to carry on.
Yep.
And
And is there a moment, a story that comes to mind that was kind of one of these teaching moments, one of these stories that you will never forget and that are like a lighthouse for you, that you remember, that you tell others?
I think for me, it was that particular moment again, losing my practice, because it was everything that I worked so hard. And I was devastated. I thought that was it, that I was going to be seen as a failure in my community, to my other colleagues. And yet it was not until I started out in shelter medicine. And in the late 2000s, shelter medicine was never heard of. It was new. It was something that you never thought that you would find a veterinarian in an animal shelter, no less one the size that I joined in. And in that sense, I kind of felt like I had been seen as a failure to my colleagues because of some of the meetings that we would go to as a group, and I would hear some of the comments. And over the course of 3 to 5 years, their conversations and their perspectives changed. Now, I was seen as back in that group. But then, by my 10th year at the shelter, I was like the shelter medicine vet. I was the one that they would communicate with me and say, "Wow, I don't know how it is you do what you do. And you've really done some amazing work at the shelter." So I kind of felt that out of this horrible, depressive situation, feeling like a failure, not a failure at all, and yet rising to an occasion to take on something that had never been done and bring the shelter to a really good, respectable place in the community was that moment for me. Because it felt like I had a comeback, like I was back. And I've never done anything but just look forward at that point.
Oh, Patty, thank you for sharing that, you know, and sharing such a difficult moment. And I think we can barely just start feeling what it must have meant for you. Richard Rohr called it, you know, falling upwards.
Yes. Yeah, that was a tough transition. But when I look back at where the animal shelter was, or the Humane Society, where it was when I started and where I helped bring it to. And it wasn't just all me. It was, I had leaders next to me. I was leading my team, and there was another team and another team. And there were three of us who just kept pushing forward. And we did.
So that community of other leaders was a source of energy for you, feeling, you know, they have my back and we're doing this together. Was that what kept you?
Yes, because I always say I'm a good chief, but I'm a much better Indian. I'm a much harder worker. So I feed off of the idea and the energy and the passion of those around me. And I think it just helps me become a little bit better when I'm in those situations, when I'm by myself.
Yeah. Oh, Penny, that's definitely true for myself. I love working with the people that surround me, and the mere fact that they're there gives me energy. And so thank you for, you know, traveling with us a little bit into the recent past. And you said you also get a lot of energy from mentoring people, and it's also part of what you do on a daily basis and something that I like to give back. So if you could be my mentor, and if I was a vet, and if I had the privilege of being an apprentice with you, if you like, a chief energy officer apprentice, because that's what you are from me, and I could work with you for a year, what would you like me to learn? What would you show me? What would you like me to unlearn if I could be an apprentice with you?
I would teach you the art of being, because I work on this every day, being patient with yourself. You're going to, every day is a new experience. Every day brings you an opportunity to learn something. But the most important thing that I would want you to learn, either by listening or watching or doing together, is the art of compassionate communication. The animals can't tell you. You just have to have this intuitive sense of what may be going on. But if you stop long enough and listen to the owners, who know them better than anything, it's the art of listening. It's the art of looking at them, making that eye contact, nodding your head that says, yes, I hear you. And you also have to be not patient with yourself, but you do have to be patient with them. They come in and they're anxious and they're fearful and they want everything done right. And they're relying on me to reassure them that everything's going to be fine. So it's not just having the ability to, I can do this procedure and that procedure, and I can diagnose based upon this lab report that I'm reading. Yes, you can be a real good technical doctor, but I think unless you can drop that long enough and connect with the human, that's going to be your most important thing to learn. And it's not easy to learn. We were not taught in vet school client communication. We had 1 week client communication, maybe 1 week business administration. So they don't teach you those skills. And if you're like me, who tends to be somewhat shy in the background, don't like to make a lot of conversations, hard to start up a conversation, it's taken a lot of work to do that. So by throwing me in front of the camera for National Geographic, I had no choice. I had to find that part of me that wasn't afraid to be there for the other person. And so for me to go to an exam room, I'm a good doctor, I'm a smart doctor, I'm confident in my skills, but now I have to relate and communicate with a person who doesn't have the same level of skill that I do. And I think it's important to engage with another human and bring them into that situation where they feel comfortable. And so when I'm talking to my clients, I try to make it as basic as possible. I don't like talking over them or down to them. So I'm always on a stool, very much like you and I are here, and I'm close enough to them where it's like, okay, so tell me, what's going on? What are you noticing? Mm-hmm. You know, it makes the whole experience easier for everybody.
I can so relate to that. I'm thinking, well, compassionate communication, what a lovely term, mm-hmm. is probably not on the agenda of many MBAs and business schools. And so essential, because there are many clients coming in, other colleagues, people from other business units, right? Mm-hmm. With fears and worries. And so I was just thinking, if I wanted to make compassionate communication this my come from, my starting point, right? My what I'm standing on, what would I need to believe to actually do that?
I think our ability to just listen, and try to, at the same time, be fast enough to be able to communicate what it is they're needing to hear you say. I may have 15 different clients in a day. There's going to be 15 different emotions, 15 different expectations. 15 different people who are either going to be ready to listen to what we have to say. They may be in denial with what I have to say. But it goes back to the same concept of that noise and silence. You just have to be able to just be there 100% to listen to that other person.
I think every leader can relate to that.
And it is very difficult, because many times I will have gone from one room to the next, back and forth. And then I walk out of a room and there's two or three messages. And in the back of my mind, it's like, I got to get to this. But now I need to stop and just be there. And it can be difficult to manage all these different processes that are coming. But I think if we can just silence the noise long enough to just be there in that moment, that's a really tough skill. And I think that's one of the most important skills in this profession, or any profession where you are communicating with someone coming in for your service and talking with.
We often refer to that as being here now. And it's so wonderful how this seems to be at the very center of everything that we touched upon, you know, from how, you know, the role of leadership in hectic, fast-paced environments, the ability to create emotions, to make smart, difficult choices in difficult environments, presence. And I'm just looking at time and thinking maybe it's the right moment to do that right now and take that one breath and look back at our conversation. And maybe as a way to, well, either summarize if needed at all, or find the essence of it. If you had a magic wand and you could make just one wish that would make our organizations, be they a clinic or any organization, just significantly better led, and you had one wish free and it would just happen to make this more humanly led organizations, what would you use the wish for?
Kindness.
Mm-hmm. And why is that so?
Because I think that is the basic ingredient for anything. If we can't be kind and be gentle and be thoughtful and considerate, then without that is your inability to love other people for who they are. And I think if, you know, it's like the Dalai Lama. If you can pick one religion, what would it be? It would be kindness. Or there's a quote similar to that. Mm-hmm. If you could be one thing, what would it be? To be kind. If I had one wish for organizations, for families, for friends, for communities, for everybody, would be to be kind.
Well, Patty, that sounds like closing words. You are, for me, an embodiment of kindness with yourself and with myself and so many others. You're radiating kindness. And I'm glad that you brought that here. And maybe it will be an inspiration to some people who listen to this today. So thank you for that. It's been an honor, a gift. I feel profoundly touched and moved from the bottom of my heart. Thank you.
Me too. And thank you for thinking of me to spend time with you. It's always such a endearing emotion I have with you and Sophia, Luis, and yes, Francesca. You're like my faraway family.
And I
I know we will one day be united.
Yes, we will. And I know that one of these days I'm going to watch Sophia graduate from the School of Veterinary Medicine. So, she will.
I believe that too.
Yeah.
I'll press the button now.